This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about racism as a factor in mental health. And to start off, I've got a definition for race from a book called Teaching for Diversity and Social Change. That is, a social construct that artificially divides people into distinct groups based on certain characteristics such as skin colour, ancestral heritage, cultural affiliation, cultural history, or ethnicity classification. So we had some trouble getting a really good definition for racism, but I think that one, as a definition for race, sets quite a good basis, and then racism is discrimination based on anything outlined there.
That you're right, it gives a good overarching kind of description, doesn't it? Because it's really interesting when you drill down, and there's an amazing TED talk actually by a lady called Nina Jablonski, who it's a real scientific talk if anybody's interested, but it really drills down where literally skin colour comes from and the science behind race, and that, like, literally depending on where your ancestors were born in terms of proximity to the equator, depended upon how dark then your skin was or how light your skin was. And in time, it's society and culture that has developed these race narratives, I guess, that make it what we think of it to be today. Basically, it's just about, yeah, pigmentation, and that is it, literally.
Yeah, and that's the tricky thing, isn't it? That whilst we can define that easier, racism can be so all-encompassing, it's quite difficult to define because there are instances of it where it's a very specific incident that somebody experiences, and there's versions of it where it's built into societies and laws and how things function. But ultimately, a lot of it comes from that idea that somehow we are different based on these characteristics. And particularly in our modern world, that could hardly be further from the truth. And there's so many ways in which we're integrated now that just make that concept seem quite farcical. Any number of factors are likely to be more different based on where the person is, for example, as opposed to what the person looks like.
Absolutely, you're right, in terms of our connectedness with each other. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so it's long, long overdue that this thing that shouldn't have existed in the first place is overturned. And so I was really glad to get into this conversation with Grace Barrett, a wonderful past guest who it was lovely to catch up with, and shares a lot of these nuanced experiences from her personal experience and also through her work in education. And so we've got some stats before we get into that. First off, from the NHS, they studied 16 specific ethnicity groups and found that of them, Black Caribbean people had the highest rate of detention under the Mental Health Act in England. So that is when we think of someone being sectioned, they are sectioned under that specific act. And this one is really key because it raises questions not only about why is this group of people more commonly maybe getting to the point of sectioning, you know, is what's happening in terms of the preventative measures before someone's mental ill health gets to that extreme. But then there's also questions of where discrimination could fit into this as well. That historically, Black people have been portrayed as other in various ways, one of which being that they are somehow more aggressive than people of other skin colours. And I do worry that this kind of portrayal sometimes comes into these decisions of who gets sectioned and who doesn't, in terms of when you're assessing under the Mental Health Act, a core part of that is this person a threat to themselves or others? And if you somehow have been influenced by these things, would you be slightly more likely to section a person who's Black than a person who's white, for example?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? Absolutely. The perceptions that we all hold or don't think about. Look, there's this whole thing between racism and anti-racism. So it's really interesting that people might, especially like healthcare professionals who do an amazing job, as we know, may not lead with a racist outlook, but they check their own biases, you know, regularly. Is that even a thing? Or do we just do what we've always done? And as you said, it just kind of perpetuates this cycle that Black men in particular of a certain age are being sectioned more than anybody else. And, you know, Black people and people of colour have poorer mental health outcomes than the rest of the population in the UK. So we've got to look at that and start from somewhere. And there's been this myth for so long that there's something biological going on. And as we said, when we look at even going back to that definition about race, we know that that's a complete myth. So there are other factors. And if people need to be sectioned under the Mental Health Act for their own safety and the safety of others, absolutely, that's what needs to happen. But as you mentioned rightly, Bob, what's led to that in the first place, the systemic nature of racism, when we think about access to mental health support, when we think about education, when we think about opportunities within the workplace, when we think about social injustice, all of those things that are key contributors and risk factors for somebody developing a mental illness. And then we start to take into account culture and religious factors within ethnic minority groups and why there is stigma. These issues go undetected, or they're not spoken about maybe as openly. We know there's a stigma with the population when we talk about mental health, but within certain minority groups, even more so. And as we know, if things aren't dealt with, they get worse and worse and worse. And then once you're in hospital and everyone else around you seems to, you know, when I first went to visit a family member for me who was first sectioned at, I think, 19, the population of the ward were like 80% Black young men. And you're like, oh my God, what is this? Why is this? So even for the healthcare staff, imagine if you're working in that organisation and this is what you see all the time, you know, how likely you are to kind of, I don't know, for want of a better term, tar everybody with the same brush, you know? Oh, this is what we see. These are our patients. This is what they generally look like.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting perspective. I'd not quite thought of that side of it. But something else you mentioned that I really want to highlight is you said about the kind of intention that ultimately you don't have to have ill intent in order to discriminate. And I think this is really important about this topic because sometimes people can get very defensive, and I understand why. You know, that's hopefully a good sign that people understand that racism is wrong if they get defensive when talking about it. But ultimately, there are times when we are all guilty of perpetuating things, even if we do it by accident. And so, you know, if this is an example that people aren't quite connecting with as much, you know, where we're talking about a very specific part of the law and a very specific experience, one thing that has been commonly tread is we've talked a lot about gender stereotyping and how discrimination can exist because of that. You know, and I'm an example where I went many years not knowing I had an eating disorder because I hadn't seen men with eating disorders in the media. You know, I just didn't think it was possible, or it was so unlikely that it just wouldn't be me. And that is not something where I had ill intent to myself. And that's not something where I purposely, you know, was being ignorant about how widespread that area of mental illness is for men. I didn't know any better. And so if I was in a medical capacity and no one had corrected me, is it possible that I might have underdiagnosed men with eating disorders? I can absolutely see that being possible. You know, and it wouldn't be me purposely trying to discriminate, but this is how, you know, the lack of information or the kind of representation we can see can influence us so much. You know, we talk all the time about internalized stigma, internalized racism is a big problem. And another really clear example of this with mental health is that according to the British Medical Journal, they reported in 2016 that people of colour are more likely to develop mental ill health, like you mentioned, due to higher exposure to risk factors, including overt and covert discrimination. But contrasting that, the Royal College of Physicians reported in 2018 that although Black British adults specifically had the highest average score for severity of mental health symptoms, they were the least likely to receive treatment for mental illness. And so there's this real contrast there, and it's likely that it's a whole range of factors. You know, it would be so much easier if we could pin this on something simple. And oftentimes when we look at conversations of racism in our media, people are attracted to those simpler examples. You know, if, for example, we were to have a guest on who had experienced a racist attack and had gone on to be diagnosed with PTSD, that's the kind of stuff that is perhaps easiest to talk about at some points, because people like a cause and effect, something that seems simpler to quantify. Whereas actually a lot of the issues that we're talking about in these stats are a build-up of all kinds of factors.
Yeah, and we don't see, you know, until now, where we're starting to see much more information, you know, from documentaries to articles and blogs and films about racism and, you know, in its entirety, really, from history to even, you know, looking at, you know, this week, a documentary on why Black women are 4 to 5 times more likely to die during childbirth or pregnancy related issues than white women. We see there's such a vast amount of information out there now. A bit of like our guest that we had last week, Bob, you know, when we were talking about headlines, and it was so important when we think about the kind of headlines and how they influence us. You know, it's a thing. That's a whole other story, isn't it, talking about that?
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. It's this, for me, a kind of contrast where we see a lot of media, including, you know, particularly for me, seeing a lot of movies that document historic discrimination. And there's this kind of disconnect where it's like either one thing or another. So either it's looking at things historically as if more of this is in the past than it actually is, or there's that disconnect of you see the mental health impact portrayed but not named or acknowledged. You know, you see how racism harms people. You read, whether that's in the news, whether that's movies, books, but so often it's not named as this person had this diagnosis, or there's this stat about how this community has been affected. You know, that seems to be where there's kind of the missing link. So I'm really glad to talk to Grace today and have her personal experience alongside where she similarly only in recent years is beginning to make some of these connections of, oh, this part of my experience made my mental health more challenging to keep.
Yeah, absolutely, Bobby, because we've never, it was only even when I started learning, you know, studying more about mental health a few years ago, like I specifically like, you know, clinical mental health, like I realised there was just no discussion then when we looked at risk factors for different illnesses around with to do with race at all, nothing. Sexuality was there, gender bias was there, addiction was, you know, abuse was there, other, you know, elements that can impact, you know, from a society point of view, family point of view, you know, an upbringing, environment, poverty, all of the other things that we know are risk factors. Racism was never there. It's only been recently that we're actually acknowledging it. And like you said, Grace mentioned that. And for a lot of us who, one, because it was just something that maybe we didn't think about unless we were actually called a name, like I was, or and Grace was, I think, and perhaps obviously we know many people weren't. That general interpersonal racism that we hear, which is what we're taught racism to be, really, that name calling, bullying, you know, there's so many more dimensions to racism, as you said at the top of the show. That interpersonal name calling, abuse, you know, get back to where you come from, the N-word, the P-word, all those things that we've just heard for years and years and years. Unless it's that, and even when it was that, you still didn't always feel like you could say, but unless it was that, it was just never, there was never anything else. There was never just that awareness of that general discrimination and that isolation and that injustice that you can feel. And so because of that, it's never really been something that maybe you, it's almost like two and two together, you know, that, wow, has that really happened to me? It's only on deep reflection and I guess maybe feeling empowered to be able to talk about it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the time it honestly doesn't come to you because you don't have necessarily the comparison. So another stat we've got from the Harvard Business Review states that people in America with, it's put it in air quotes, white sounding surnames receive 50% more callbacks for job applications than people with, again, in air quotes, black sounding names. And that is something that absolutely I've seen firsthand. In, you know, elements of recruitment I've been involved in, I've seen that kind of discrimination exist. I've got, you know, a friend who has a different last name to his parents because they were worried about their son, this 6'4" big Jamaican black guy, what his employment chances would be like with the family name that they had. And so he has a different last name from his parents for that reason. And that, you know, that's heartbreaking for me, but it's not uncommon. And, you know, it's
not uncommon.
And it's horrible to think that his parents were clued into that. And it seemed more possible to change his name, have a different name to your son, than it did for things to change and be more fair. And so it's crazy. But then at the same time, you know, you look at a stat like that, and if you were either side of that fence, unless you have the comparison, you don't know. You know, I know what rate of callbacks I'm used to getting from a job. I don't necessarily know how that compares to a specific friend of mine, unless you're job hunting together. And so I think that's something and I think that's something particularly for the listeners to bear in mind when listening to Grace's experiences today, because for much of her education, she was the only person of colour in her schooling environments. And so whenever she was treated differently, not only did she have nobody else that could say, oh, yes, me too, you know, she didn't have that of other people experiencing the same things to let her know, oh, this is something different to this just being that people have a problem with you specifically as an individual, as opposed to there being factors like racism at play. And then also that's compounded by the loneliness and the isolation of it. If you're being treated differently for something that also sets you aside as the only person to have that characteristic, then who can she talk to? You know, of course you would feel excluded in that environment. And, you know, she talks about like discrimination in terms of her education as well. And I can see how it happens and it goes unchecked, particularly when you're in such a minority. And we've got one last stat here from We Forum, who did a survey among teachers and students and found that teacher perceptions were seen as the biggest barrier to educational success of all the different factors they looked at.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's where it starts, right? I was talking to someone the other day, Bobby, who's a teacher, and said, we realised when we looked at our books and our literature in a primary school, and this is January 2021, that we didn't have any literature that was about, that had black characters or characters that weren't white, unless it was about the slave trade. We realised that we didn't have anything. So I spoke to the head about this because I thought, surely this isn't right. And anyway, the head gave me some money to go and buy some books that were diverse in their characters and their storylines. And when I brought the books back into the school, this is the teacher saying this to me, the books were placed on two shelves outside of the library in the reception area of the school, in a completely different place to the library that held all the other books. And these were for the kids that were, you know, and for books that were like special books that had characters that were black or non-white in them. And she said, I just knew it wasn't right. And I knew that he didn't mean anything by it when he told me to do it. But she said, I had to challenge it. And I'm like, are we really having this conversation? Like, that is so heartbreaking. I've got children at primary school, right? To think that books that have got black characters in them in 2021 that are diverse in their nature are put in a different area to the rest of the books. The black characters are in a different place in school. And I was like, wow. I said, you guys are getting a shock if you come to the city. Like, it's like our school cover black history throughout the whole year. It's not a separate, it's just history. It's just part of history. So I guess I'm lucky. And it's not until I've worked with other people and teachers and listened to other people, like, I'm not naive to this, but specifically in schools, realizing that I'm classifying myself and my children lucky that we go to a school that is representative of the world in their literature and their teaching. That I'm lucky, am I, that that's my situation. I mean, shit. And that was just heartbreaking to me, to think of those black children in that school that are seeing themselves as so different.
Right. Well, it's a very physical example of othering. And I think one of the traps of racism can be that we get stuck on certain things, you know, that shouldn't be an issue. In the same way, a lot of progress has been made in terms of like LGBT teaching. There was a time when you could be struck off as a teacher under Margaret Thatcher for even mentioning that gay people exist You don't even have to say anything positive. Even mentioning the existence of gay people, you could lose your right to teach. Yeah. And that is not the case, thank God, anymore. And so, understandably, you shouldn't be keeping certain books out of the classroom. You know, if a best-selling kids' book happens to have gay parents in it, then there's not a clear reason for that not to be in a library where a lot of kids might be like, oh, I've heard of this book, I want to read it, it's popular with my friends.
Absolutely.
And so it's one of these odd things where it shouldn't be a big issue, but sometimes it is. And that's the thing that's baffling, that we shouldn't be getting stuck on these things. In the same way, you know, for me growing up, one of the biggest book series, of course, Harry Potter. Imagine if we had not been allowed Harry Potter books in the library because not all the characters are white. You know, imagine how ludicrous that would be. And so the conversation shouldn't be about we need to have diversity in our books so much as why don't we have diversity in the characters of our books? You know, in the same way, in my school, no doubt people would have been very angry if we couldn't get our hands on Harry Potter. Not everyone's parents are in the position to go buy them the full series of books.
Yeah, absolutely.
And talking about education, that links very much to Grace's experience, not only in terms of her experiences of discrimination within education, but now going on to be an educator herself. So previously, when she was on the show, it was representing Self-Esteem Team, a business she co-runs, where they go into schools and they teach mental health education alongside self-esteem and body confidence and all these wonderful things that can now be in addition to the progress that mental health education we've been involved with. So it's really lovely to see our respective work developing side by side. And then more recently, she launched I Am Ally, which is specifically education around anti-racism in schools, and particularly working to embed that within the teaching community. So as opposed to it being an outside speaker that maybe comes in here and there and gives some classes, instead work on ways to train teachers to be more aware around discrimination, racism, but also they are more aware of spotting racism and certain distinct kinds of bullying that can exist in classrooms. So yeah, wonderful guest to talk about this topic with, who really openly shares her experience and is just a delight to catch up with. We love Grace.
Yeah, I think Grace is absolutely fantastic. She was so open, and it was just brilliant to hear her speak about her personal experiences. And what's interesting is the fact that she's mixed race, as am I, and our perspective, I think, even though I say so myself, is really interesting and one that's not actually maybe spoken about as much. But I think overall, it just goes to show how unique we all are as human beings. And it's really about being open and listening and I guess receiving and embracing everybody's experience, you know, with empathy.
For sure. And I'm really glad she shared that perspective as well, because I think so often on difficult conversations, we can look for the simplest examples. And we know within the mental health world, that isn't always helpful. That means that so often people jump on giving examples always of depression and anxiety, for example, because they're the ones that are maybe people have more examples in their head that they've seen in the media, for example. But that doesn't mean that that's the only experience. And it's the same with this. You know, whilst her experience and your experience are more nuanced and might be more difficult for some people to describe, the answer is not we don't talk about them. And for a long time, we have fallen into this trap. And racism, unfortunately, is all our issue. But that does mean we can all be part of the solution. And so that's why I'm glad to talk about it. You know, I'm always up for talking about this topic, and great to have Grace on to get into depth on it. So with that all said, we'll get into this episode with Grace Barrett in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. It's great to be partnering again with Wild, the natural deodorant company. Mentor was actually the first podcast they ever sponsored, and thanks to you, our brilliant listeners, they're delighted with how that went.
So in case you missed it, let's talk about the product. Wild has created truly sustainable deodorant that not only does the job, but smells great. You just buy one aluminium case that lasts a lifetime and holds biodegradable deodorant refills.
I'm chuckling to myself because you said aluminium, and I've started saying aluminum because I've been watching too much American telly.
Yeah, Bobby, get off Netflix.
I'm even starting to think aluminum makes more sense. I'm going to get some hate mail now. All right, so the product. Their unisex scents include orange zest, fresh cotton sea salt, and their new lavender haze, which is my new favourite. So not only does this deodorant do a great job, you'll be smug in the choice of mix and match scents.
You can even personalise the case to make it really your own, which I love. Most of us stick with one deodorant for a lifetime, even though it may not be the best fit. This one has a 100% satisfaction guarantee, so it's as risk-free as life gets. Plus, as one of our listeners, you'll get 20% off by using the code MENTAL.
So join us today in going wild for natural deodorant at wearewild.com with code MENTAL at checkout. It's sustainable, effective, discounted, and linked in the episode description. Wild, it's kinder to the planet and your pits. Honestly, I would love it if one day these silly little taglines I make up, one of them takes on. That would make me so happy.
Oh, it would. I think it's hilarious. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Grace Barrett, and whilst I have many experiences with regards to mental health, as I'm sure we all do, there's something that I think is super relevant to what we're talking about today, which is my relationship with mental health and race. So I'm just going to tell you a little story about when I was at school. So I grew up in a farming village, essentially, and I went to a school where there were very few people of colour. 4 years old, I started school, you know, a couple of weeks after I'd moved to the area. And I remember thinking that I was kind of excited to be starting school. I had no awareness, aged four, that I was different, let's say. I wasn't aware of that. I just thought, you know, I was a little girl like all the other little girls. And I rocked up at school and I started trying to make friends. And at break time, another little girl came over to me and she said, "Oh, hello, are you the new black family?" And I didn't know the answer to that question because I was 4 years old and I wasn't aware that I was the new black family, right? And so my relationship with my race started out as a really confusing one. And as I moved through school, there were more and more of these moments where other people would make observations about me and my race and what that meant. And I think I felt as I grew up that it was really hard for me to define who I was. And as I turned into a teen, I started to experience struggles with my mental health, but I'd never connected that to my relationship with race. I started to experience depression and like this intense need to isolate myself from people. And I still have this today, actually. Some days I just find it way too much to even consider going outside. Like the world for me is somewhere that feels like I'm gonna receive a lot of scrutiny. And often I just don't want to deal with that. And so sometimes it's hard for me to know whether my depression is triggered by not wanting to go outside or not wanting to go outside is triggered by my depression. That's something that I'm still finding hard to unpick. But yeah, like I say, as a teen, I started to experience depression. I started to experience anxiety. And on the surface of it, I was always super confident and the kid in the class that would always put their hand up and answer a question or would try and make everybody laugh. And I think that's how I saw myself as well. I saw myself as confident. I believed that I was strong and personable. So consequently, I think it took me a long time to understand that I was experiencing mental health issues. And it took me even longer to understand that some of those mental health issues might be connected to my experience with racism. And in fact, to put that in context, I'm 31 and I've only just in the last 2 years found a therapist that looks like me. And in doing that, I've been able to understand that one of the reasons I've continually struggled with my mental health, and one of the reasons maybe that I have a mood disorder and that I experience psychosis and depression, is potentially because I've lived in repeated trauma. And that repeated trauma, I'm coming to learn, is the trauma of racism. I remember meeting my therapist and sort of saying, "These are my issues, this is what I struggle with." And she said that she'd never met somebody who experienced psychosis who hadn't experienced trauma. And I said, you know, I agree with that in principle, but the trouble is I'm not traumatized. I had, you know, I said I had a loving family. My parents are not divorced. I've always been able to make friends. I have a career that I'm passionate about. Where's the trauma? And I think that now it seems so ridiculous that the thing that is traumatic is the thing that's most noticeable about me. It's the thing that people spot about me right away. It's the thing that little girl noticed about me when we were 4 years old. My trauma is racism. And I'm only just starting to understand the impact that that's had on my life and the impact that that's had on my mental health, really.
For sure. Well, thank you for sharing that. I think that's something that a lot of people will connect to. And I think it really speaks to how, right from a young age, our first perspective is always our own. That you went into that new environment and you didn't know anything different. You know, you looked down and you saw a little girl's body and didn't think beyond that. And it's only then when confronted by other people's perceptions that can get complicated. And particularly for something as fundamental as skin colour, it can so undermine your ability to understand who you are if people are constantly challenging something that for you is just default. This is just how you came. You don't know any different.
Yeah, completely. And I think, as I've grown up, the thing that I find most difficult with that is that my skin colour has absolutely influenced the experience that I have, because the world interacts with me differently because of my skin colour. So if my skin colour has influenced my experience, then my skin colour does influence who I am. It shouldn't, but the reality is that it does. And that's something that it's taken me a long time to reach a level of acceptance with that. I've kind of just been in denial about it. Like, you know, no, I'm just Grace. This is irrelevant and it should be irrelevant. But the reality is that it's not.
Right. Of course, we want it to be irrelevant. And I think for a lot of people, if they've not had that firsthand experience, it can be easier to think that it is, you know, with that idealistic thing like you did. But you had the experience that confronted that and you had to acknowledge that wasn't the case. Whereas I think for a lot of white people, I can give, you know, certainly that experience where you don't have a lot of certain types of discrimination. But one thing I have experienced, which maybe is the complete opposite of that, is I get assumptions in the other direction, where because I'm white and I look like what people imagine when they think of Britishness, people still predominantly think of whiteness, even though that is not reflective of the diversity of the country we live in. That is still the connection. And so I get this version of it sometimes where people assume, A, that I am English, and B, that I understand always the same reference points that everybody else does. And so then I have to explain that I'm Irish or that I'm from Birmingham. And so I might sound a bit like I'm from London to some people, but I'm not. And it's like we all make these assumptions, but those ones are not discriminatory.
That's so important when you talk about this, because so often when you talk to people about bias or, you know, assumptions, it's like, well, but we all do that all the time to everyone. And that's true. But there is a key difference in that prejudgment doesn't always amount to oppression. You know, sometimes a prejudgment is just a prejudgment. For people that have been oppressed or are still oppressed, so people of colour, people who do not identify as straight, people who do not identify as cisgender, there's oppression that comes with those judgments. And so the judgments become damaging because of the oppression. The judgment in and of itself doesn't have to be damaging, but we can't escape the fact that some of those judgments come with a whole load of baggage. So for somebody like me, being judged can be a problem. And to varying degrees, right? I'm mixed race and I have very light skin. So the judgments that I receive are incredibly different to the judgments that my father receives or my uncles or many other people. And so it's also really important to have it straight in your head as an adult. It's important to take time getting it straight in your head. What do I receive? Do I receive judgments and oppression? Do I just receive judgments? And in the grand scheme of things, the scale, like, where do I sit? I think it's really important to do that, because without awareness, you can't figure out what to do next.
Yeah, And that's the difficulty of it, is this nuance of all these different levels of it, and all of them require a level of understanding. You know, so yes, I may have had many interactions with people where they look at me as a white guy and I see them be disappointed that I'm not as similar to them as they had assumed. But there's a real privilege in that compared to someone maybe meeting you and assuming you're different and that they can't relate to you. And yeah. Then you have to work past that. And so often that's where racism inherently ends up being the burden, particularly of people of colour, because you end up being the one that's trying to convince people, no, we can relate. We are the same. I do understand your experiences and some of the ways that maybe you're not intentionally doing these things. I just hope you'll also make the effort to understand my experiences too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've identified for a long time as somebody who's a people pleaser. And I've noticed, you know, throughout my journey with my mental health more generally, I've noticed that this is something I do, and it can kind of set off a set of experiences that are problematic for my mental health. But I, again, up until recently, hadn't realized that potentially so much of that people-pleasing behavior comes from looking the way that I do and the way that the world interacts with me. I walk into the world knowing that I have to convince people either that I'm not a threat, or that I am educated, or that I'm not purposefully being combative or difficult. In some ways that happens. In other ways, I have to convince people that I don't think I'm better than because I happen to have light skin. So you're constantly walking this line of trying to ensure that you don't end up in a hostile situation. And that's a responsibility that I wear much more than a lot of people I know. And I think it is at the root of my people-pleasing nature. My instant response to other human beings is, you're probably going to find me difficult, and so I need to neutralize that. And how can I not carry that through into every interaction that I have with people throughout my life? I mean, I'm working on it, and identifying it is the important part. But I think, yeah, you can start to see how so much of what we talk about with regards to mental health can have really clear roots in being a person of colour. It creates behaviours that create things in the brain that aren't conducive to good mental health.
Yeah. And I was listening to a conversation on another podcast recently where they were talking about how universal that can be. Whatever minority you're part of, you have to understand the majority as part of your survival, as part of you fitting in, as part of you getting a job, whatever elements of your life where fitting in is a necessity to you doing well and getting through each day. And that's therefore inherently a more difficult position to be in. Not only does that explain the unseen burden that a lot of people carry of trying to constantly filter their behavior because of other people's prejudices, it also explains why there's this weird hypocrisy where you, as a mixed race woman, are expected to understand the culture of white people. Like, if there was something that a lot of white people understand that you don't, that could be held against you. Whereas I have not found myself in a position where it's held against me that I don't understand certain elements of black culture.
And here's the trick with being mixed race, is that whilst you do receive a lot of privilege as a mixed race person, you are also constantly walking both lines all of the time, because you're right, white people will expect me to understand parts of white culture. Black people will also expect me to understand parts of black culture. So it feels like I'm always just about to make a mistake and upset somebody. And whilst I completely acknowledge the privilege that mixed race people experience compared to black people, particularly women, I think, well, it is across gender, but I do think because women are sort of programmed to believe that our value is connected to our beauty, because of all of the bullshit around beauty ideals and the colorism that we have in the world, as well as the racism, a woman who looks like me is going to get a much easier time in terms of what women are expected to be But I also think that one something that isn't particularly discussed is the challenges around identity that mixed race people experience and the challenges around connection, you know, that I'm also expected to understand these other parts of my life and my heritage. So, yeah, I think the mixed race perspective is something that isn't talked about massively. And I understand why, but I also think as a mixed race person in the conversation, I should talk about it.
For sure, absolutely. It's a big issue that I know a lot of my friends struggle with. And I think there can be this pressure to choose of which side do you represent.
Well, and I think, again, that comes back round to like the judgment in and of itself wouldn't have to be a problem unless there's something associated with that. So you're right, like people will see my blackness before they see my whiteness. And like something I talk about with my mum quite a lot. My mum appears white, but her dad is actually Indian Irish and her mum is English. So she is also mixed race, but she appears white. And whenever we're together, like we're incredibly similar as people. We have incredibly similar mannerisms. We look very similar, but it's only when people get to know us that they go, God, don't you two look alike? You know, nobody ever assumes that she's my mom, for example. They see my dad and they assume that he's my dad. I actually probably look less like him, right? But I have darker skin than my mom. So the assumption is that she's not related to me. And that happens all the time. Yes, absolutely. I think that highlights that people see my blackness before they see my whiteness. That shouldn't be a problem, right? It shouldn't be an issue that people see my blackness first. That could be fine. It's not that it's important that people see my whiteness. It's important that we are able to remove the value judgments attached to white and black, because then it's irrelevant what you see first. I know that we're a million miles away from that, but I think it's, you know, it's important to differentiate. It's that we need to remove the value judgment.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the baggage that comes with that. That they see this one element of you and might assume any number of stereotypes.
Yeah, and also I think in terms of like creating change, I don't really mind if people make assumptions about my personality per se. I think it's about my ability and my capacity where it really gets me. And there are lots of things that make people make those judgments. Like that can be to do with age, that can be to do with being a woman. And as somebody who started a business really young. I started my business when I was like 24, I think, 23, 24, and I'm a woman, and I'm a woman of color. I was consistently receiving this kind of feedback that was like surprise that I was competent at what I did, surprise that I ran my own business, surprise. And I could never figure out, like, is that because I'm a woman or because I'm young or because I'm brown, or is it all of them? And it may well be, it may well have been all of them, but I think the limiting beliefs that we have about people's capacity, I think that's the stuff that to me really connects with oppression. If I'm working for somebody else and they get to decide how quickly I am offered a promotion, how quickly I escalate through a company, the idea that you have about my capacity, that matters. And the same in education. So when I was at school, I mean, it seems so, it almost feels trivial to talk about this, but I know that it's really important. So when I was at school, I did my SATs in year six, and I think you had to get fours as the result to pass. And you could get a five or a six, but a four was like, you're average, you're doing fine. And I got two fives and a four in my SATs. When everyone was sorted into their groups at secondary school based on these results, I found myself in the lowest attainment group in the school. Even though I'd exceeded average, I was placed way below average. And this was something that I was kept in that group for the best part of a year, a school year. And whilst experiencing that way of being taught, the expectation of my capacity was incredibly low, right? So I was just encouraged to do some colouring in and then go and take things to different teachers around the school, run errands for teachers, stuff like that. I was not encouraged to stretch myself, challenge myself. And when teachers were asked about, okay, these are Grace's results, why has she ended up in these sets? Oh, well, we just want to make sure that she can consistently achieve that level of work. But they weren't putting me in a situation where I could prove that I could consistently achieve that level of work, right? And every other child who had achieved the results that I achieved was either in the middle set or the top set. And all of those kids were white, right? I was the only one that wasn't white. So the judgments that we have about people's capacity can be hugely problematic. And those are ideas that are perpetuated often by the systems that we live in. So at the time that I was being educated, schools would receive more funding if the BAME students in their school got grades above a C in their GCSEs. Now, that perpetuates the idea that it's much harder to get black and brown children to pass their exams. So you'll get more money if you do it. And whilst that may be the case, it may be harder, it's not to do with the intelligence level of those people. It's to do with the circumstances that they live in. But that was never properly communicated. So in the area that I grew up, white people assumed that I was going to be less intelligent because I'm mixed race. And essentially, I was set up to live out that experience because I was receiving a lower standard of education for the first year of secondary school. So those judgments about capacity, if you just by looking at me decide that I'm going to be really funny and really outgoing, I can see how that can be problematic in some ways. What if I'm not? What if I'm really shy? All of those things. It's a hurdle to get over, but that's very different to, you know, making a judgment about what somebody can achieve and, yeah, their capacity. And I think we have to focus on, we have to focus on unpicking racist ideologies around people's potential and capacity.
Absolutely. Ultimately, what you've described is that you got these really excellent grades, and it was easier for people to think that that was some kind of fluke than that was an honest reflection of your ability, which, not for nothing, that's what the SATs are for, to assess how schools are achieving across the achievements of their individual pupils. Like, that's what the test is about. So they're not believing their own thing. And like you said, then there's this weird incentivizing of extra money for BAME students that goes to the school. And it's like, well, if we understand that there's situational factors that may affect their ability, show me where that money's going to. Where are you getting extra resources in your school? Where was that actually going? Or was it to compensate the burden of, oh, well, you've got this more challenging student in your school, and so we're going to give you some extra money because we understand that's challenging for you. If you really believe that people from minority backgrounds struggle more in school, then they're the ones that are struggling, not the institution. And that's why it's just so strange when you start walking these things back and the logic just falls apart.
Completely. And I think we've been so focused in the UK of just quickly getting rid of the problem of racism, because there are some people that go, oh God, that's horrible, that's awful, let's get rid of it. But also because we want to be seen to be doing something that gets rid of the problem, right? So actually looking at how does this work? What should we and could we do about it? I think we tie ourselves in knots by trying to do these quick fix things or these things that look good. And actually, they just serve to compound the problem. You know, that kind of incentive, the way that that was managed, absolutely throughout my education compounded the problem. I had a similar experience when I was doing my A-levels about the school requiring me to get particular grades when actually, in order to go on and do the further education that I needed to do, I needed to be doing other kinds of study. And the school absolutely would not let me do that because they needed the extra money that I would get them if I got particular grade. That burden wasn't placed on anybody else in my school, right? It's just these cyclical things where you've got burden, you've got lack of expectation, you've got hurdles being placed in the way of people. And that's the stuff that people of color navigate throughout their lives continually. You know, that statement of you have to be twice as good to get half as much. It's real.
Yeah. Yeah. And so often you're exactly right in trying to address that, even from very good intentions, we can go at it from really the wrong way. Like, you remind me of other, you know, misconceptions people have about challenging life environments. Like, we did an episode all about homelessness. And the biggest factor in homelessness is family breakdown. It's not actually money. Yeah. People assume it's money, but it's what's happened that person doesn't have a relative or a friend that they can go stay with when they don't have more money. Exactly. That's the bigger factor. And so throwing money at homelessness keeps happening and keeps not fixing the problem. And, you know, this kind of feels like somewhat, you know, very different, but somewhat maybe a parallel example where there's societal issues that we need to address, and throwing money at it, whilst it might sometimes be the quick solution, it's not necessarily the good solution. And I'm interested to know as well, with your experience relating to mental health and your experience of cyclothymia that's associated with fluctuations in your mood between hypomania and depression periods, how this might have factored in, because I can see potential links where people's perceptions of you that were very different to your own perception and you struggling to figure out who you are as a result of that sounds incredibly challenging.
Yeah, I think, you know, to be 100% honest, I'm only just figuring that out. You know, I'm only just starting to understand the relationship between the two. One thing I do know is that when I found myself in an environment where I felt truly seen and truly accepted, and where the people around me were not using labels to try and define me, but they were letting me define myself, that's where the experience of psychosis changed dramatically. I heard voices regularly for, I would say, probably about 5 or 6 years. And that was sort of through my late teens and early 20s. And when I found myself in a living environment where I was around people that were willing to just properly understand me and met me without expectation, very quickly those voices disappeared. And that's not to say I've never heard a voice since then. You know, in times of stress and pressure, I have had that experience. And I have had, definitely still had experiences of hypomania in times of stress and pressure. But I think that something that is really, it's something that feels very throwaway and flippant when we talk about mental health, but all the experts I've ever met talk about it. They talk about this sense of belonging and how it's really at the root of having good mental health. And I can't really attest to that more, because as soon as I found that sense of belonging and that safe place to live, not just somewhere that I could touch in and out of, you know, every now and then or a couple of times a week, like somewhere to actually inhabit that felt like my space, my home, where I was truly accepted and understood, I just, my brain changed. And I think that now I'm understanding how understandable it is that if you don't have that around you all of the time, that your brain is going to do funny things. It's going to mess with you because you feel constantly like you can't trust the people that you're with. You feel constantly that you're about to be judged or tripped up. And so you create this real lack of trust within yourself. Your own judgment is consistently called into question if you're a person of color. And I think for me, that was, I think that was really at the heart of what was going on with some of my mood disorder. I still get depressed all the time. That hasn't gone anywhere, but it is different now. And yeah, truthfully, I don't know exactly why, but that's something that I'm trying to learn with my therapist at the moment. You're right, like it also does make it difficult. Now that I'm tracking back through experiences in my life, there's points where it becomes incredibly hazy because I wasn't very well, you know? So getting to the reality of what was going on during that time is quite difficult. And I suppose I just have to be open to understanding that how it felt at the time is as valid as the information about what happened. At the moment, I'm trying to lean into that. I might not have, you know, the perfect storyboard of what went on, but I know what I was exhibiting and I know what I was feeling, and I'm choosing to look at it through that lens.
I mean, that makes sense. I can totally understand that. My experience of depression is that many of my most difficult times are also hazy, and I've had to understand that better in hindsight. And, you know, there were many times when I was smiling through struggle, and it made me more distanced from what I was actually dealing with. It made it harder to understand what was going on for me because I was preoccupied with how I came across. And it sounds like you may have had, you know, that can come from just general stigma, plus the being on the back foot of how are people going to treat me differently based on my skin colour, which I can't control. So instead, I have to counterbalance that by controlling my behaviour and trying to be as pleasing to people as possible. It doesn't make it easier for you to get to understand yourself. And then the mental illness doesn't make it easier for you to understand what is my range of emotions and why does it make so much less sense?
I suppose I've just really come to accept that my range of emotions includes my mood disorder. And I think I've probably found this easier since being open to the idea that racism has played a huge part in how I got to where I got to. In that, while some of the things I experience emotionally might not land on the classic scale of normal, they are my normal. Like I say, I'm 31 now, and I've been living with mental health issues that I can pinpoint since I was 15. So at this point, I've lived with mental health issues for longer than I haven't. So actually, that is my range of emotions, right? Mania included and depression included. That's also why it's so important to me to try and generate change outside of my bubble, because I truly believe that my range of emotions is not going to change dramatically until the world changes dramatically. And I'm aware that that probably means in my lifetime, this is what I'm working with, right? My brain has been behaving this way for a long time. This is what I'm working with. So, yeah.
I get what you mean. Well, I have the same with stigma. It's like, you know, I am going to find stigmatizing attitudes towards mental health difficult for my whole lifetime, but I'm still going to do what I can to change it, as big and sometimes impossible to even mentally grasp as that change might be. We've got to do something, right? The progress is there, and it's been one maybe silver lining of the pandemic and the increased focus on certain issues that we've had by being trapped inside with our thoughts more. And that definitely includes racism. You know, a lot of people are having difficult conversations with their family over the last year. They're looking at their own behavior and analyzing it. And hopefully we can come out of this with some change of perception.
Yes, absolutely. I also think that 2020 for people of color has also been incredibly affronting. 2020 and 2021 has been like really affronting. For me, it definitely like threw up all the dust with regards to race. And because I am a person of colour, I can't just let that dust settle. It's not going to for me. So I think that whilst it is really important and it is progress, it's also really painful and really difficult. And I think that that's something that, again, isn't being discussed properly. Like, we're talking about, some people, you know, are talking about the trauma that we're all living through because of COVID. Not everyone, and I appreciate like that's probably a very mental health community conversation, but the trauma that people of colour are experiencing because of what's going on now is also very real. And it is really hard having to live with both of those things going on at the same time. And yeah, I mean, I don't know that I have a solution for that, because I definitely am still figuring out how I manage that issue, how I manage the fact that the media are now talking about race. Like, cool, we've wanted that for a long time. But also, the way that that conversation is happening is rough. And I haven't figured out how to manage that. And also, then the knock-on effect is that there are loads of people all around us in our lives who want to talk about race. And again, like, great, I'm glad you're talking about it now. But maybe you want to always talk about that with me. Like, ouch, that takes a lot of energy and a lot of strength. And so I think it's also worth acknowledging that. And it's hard as well, because sometimes people don't intend to talk about race. Sometimes the conversation just goes there, right? And I see this in my relationship with my partner. He's white. And what I see is that when we have conversations with friends, you know, even on Zoom, Johnny closes the laptop and goes and gets a drink and it's done. You know, the conversation's done. Probably less so now than it used to be. For me, like, that's playing in my head for the next few days. And it could be a really small thing that somebody said. It could be that they've just revealed like a stereotype that was imprinted in their brain that I didn't know existed. And suddenly I'm now confronted with like, oh, okay, that person I've known for years and who I know respects me, who I know loves me and cares about me, they also have this ideology living in their brain. And my brain goes, well, what do I do about that? What are we going to do about that problem? I need to sort it out. And that, you know, constantly running on repeat in your head is really tough. So yeah, it is a positive that the conversations are happening, but it's also just tremendously hard to manage in your life if you are brown or black, I think.
I absolutely, you know, particularly last year saw that in my friends where they were having exactly the same thing. Many of them of people constantly looking to them for education and explain this to me like it was a new issue. I think a lot of the solution is us taking more ownership of figuring out these solutions. That absolutely there are people with lived experience who need to be part of these conversations in order to inform us. But equally, we live in a time where we have Google. We have so many wonderful books that talk about racism. We can be responsible for educating ourselves. And I've been, if anything, having these conversations more to try and take more ownership of that. You know, I'm someone that talks about racism a lot in my life, and I've grown up in Birmingham and I've always been around diversity and I'm part of a minority myself. And so then I'm pleased when I see certain white friends of mine come to me with their questions, because it doesn't have the same level of firsthand trauma for me. So I don't know. I'm like, is that the call to action for this episode, that the listeners send me questions? I don't mind.
I think the call to action really is that if you want to be anti-racist or be an ally, you have a responsibility to get yourself to a point where you can have the conversations in the right way and offer yourself, so that over time, the burden is not continually placed on black and brown people. But also, now that I've started to essentially piece together all of these experiences, for so long, I compartmentalized every racist experience as something separate to the last one. So it was always, okay, that person was just an idiot. Okay, let's just like keep boxing off in separate storage boxes. And it was almost as though a couple of years ago, something happened and I just couldn't see how that wasn't connected to every single other experience I've had of racism. And it was almost like threading like a needle through a load of beads, and they suddenly just got pulled together into the same necklace, you know? And it was suddenly like, okay, this is all the same problem. And that was really valuable, but it was also really hard. And so I think it's also that if you're an ally, it's really important that you understand how everything is connected and you don't compartmentalize things. And then you let black and brown people show up when they want to show up and also not show up when they don't want to. Because I would hate to be excluded from that conversation, you know? But that's a really difficult balance to strike, because that's going to be different for everybody. Every person of color is going to have a different relationship with that. So it's tough, but it's about wanting to ask the questions and making it clear that if you're needed, then you can be called upon, you know?
I think that's a great way of phrasing it. And it really speaks to the experience of certain things that come up in the conversation being the tip of the iceberg. Like when George Floyd was murdered, there was a lot of conversation around that as if it was an isolated incident, because this is a symptom of a larger problem. This is not an isolated case. So even if, and I've come across people with certain attitudes where they really want to find a way to explain away that situation, but there's so many others, you can't explain away all of racism. And I think that's very much a position of privilege if you feel like you can. And so I guess maybe there's layers of it, where if you're in a position where you don't think racism is as bad as the papers are saying, or as bad as people of color are saying, or you don't fully understand Black Lives Matter, why isn't it called All Lives Matter? Then maybe go speak to a white person that gets it. You know, come speak to someone like me that went to the protests, and I'll talk it through with you, because I don't have the same necklace of trauma. You know, there might be elements of it. I've had minority crossover, right? But I've not got the same necklace that you have. So come talk to me about it. And then when you know enough and you're open enough to being wrong and believing people of color, then go to Grace. Come debate with me and come listen to Grace. There we go.
Yes, I love that.
Don't debate with me. I'm not here for that. If you're happy to have the debate, then that's all. And I think you've just laid it out so clearly. Like, there are layers to this conversation. There are layers to racism. And it is about what we're bringing to whose door, because, you know, everyone's feeling very different about it. Absolutely. That's so smart. Thank you for saying that.
Oh, you know what? This is just my area of social consciousness. It's all about like language and ways of explaining things. If I ever have TikTok, I think it'll be videos where I explain ways. I mean, because like I was trying to do my best on helping friends who are people of color and like firefighting when they were coming to me, like really upset and traumatized, like you've described, by the experiences, and saying, I don't know what to do. People keep asking me questions. And I was like, okay, well, here's a quick thing I say about, you know, why all lives matter doesn't make sense. Here's a thing you can say for this, because sometimes we need these ways of simplifying it, because the people that would rather debate than accept that change needs to happen and do the work as part of that change, they would much rather have the debate than have the change. That's the easier thing for many people. And I love the opportunity to try and dismantle that. And one takeaway I found last year, which was massive, was I just didn't realize the privilege I had on speaking about this stuff. Mm. Like, I've talked about racism for as long as I can remember in my life. I've always been angry about it. And it wasn't until last year that I realized how entrenched in privilege that was. You know, people connect with loud men. That is seen as normal. As a white guy, I can get angry about racism. No one's ever told me I've got a chip on my shoulder. No one's ever told me I'm playing the race card. There are whole, you know, tropes like the angry black woman idea that no one's ever going to throw my way. And on one sense, you know, you might think, oh, maybe that privilege might feel empowering. No, I don't like it. I don't want it. It feels yucky because I am benefiting from racism via other people being put down in a way that I'm not. Yuck.
Yeah. But
as long as you know that you have that and you choose to use that in a way that is helping the progress and makes it so that eventually you are not heard above anybody else, you know, then that's worthwhile. The more people like you that recognize that privilege, the better. The problem is when that privilege is not recognized and people stay silent. Like, that's, to me, that's when it's infuriating, because it's like, okay, you could go be a disruptor. You can go and shake things up and get some stuff done. And we need you to. Yeah, we need you to get on it. So, like, time's been ticking. Let's hustle up, right? And I think that I know that people have varying opinions about that, but I personally subscribe to the understanding that I have not created this. I can't create this. And so I need you to tear this down. That's kind of what I subscribe to.
No, I agree. And I think that is not normalized in the conversation as much as other parallels are, right? We understand with sexism that because we still live in a time where most people in the highest seats of power are male, we understand that men will have to be a big driving force in bringing about that change. And I mean, we could have a whole other conversation about why that might be better understood than something that clearly has a lot of crossover. But I'm really glad that the conversations are progressing and that people are understanding the nuance. And, yeah, you know, that absolutely applies to mental health. You know, I'm sick of seeing stats about people of color don't access services as if they've just decided, you know.
Oh, yeah. The ownership, the responsibility. And that is something as well that is parallels throughout all conversations about race, which is the responsibility on accessing services is being placed with people of colour, when actually it's possible that the services aren't particularly accessible to people of colour. It's also possible that they're not treated with as much compassion and empathy throughout every area of their life, and therefore they don't even realise that they need to access services. I didn't. I had no clue because no one was talking to me about how I was doing and was it really hard living in the world that I was living in. And again, like I say, I know that I'm privileged. So I understand how it was for me and I can only imagine how much worse it is for people whose circumstances are slightly different to mine or whose skin tone is different to mine.
But even the example you gave of finding the counsellor that you see now is so key. Because you found somebody that will be able to automatically spot things because of their level of understanding that otherwise may have been overlooked or the onus would have been on you to explain. And I think that's an issue that we're dealing with in almost every form within mental health. You know, still so much the onus is on us to get the help and to know what's happening with our brain at a time when the functioning of our brain is distorted. We are at a huge disadvantage there that makes it a lot harder. And so, yes, absolutely, changing the narrative around Black people aren't accessing support. It's like, well, maybe Black people aren't being offered support. Maybe there's more to this story. In the same way you get it with men. Men aren't speaking up about their needs. Well, are we asking them? You know, I read research only the other day where they were looking at conversations with GPs and GPs self-reported in this. They were aware of it, that they feel more comfortable asking female patients about their emotional life and how they're coping than they do male patients.
Yeah. And then make that a Black man, you know, then make that patient a Black male. How likely are GPs to ask a Black male about their emotions? The world we live in, I think, tells me that that's probably quite unlikely because Black men are rarely encouraged to talk about their feelings in any setting.
Well, and there's that stereotype of, you know, strength and resilience as if skin colour decides that you don't struggle. Of course it doesn't. Yeah. In the same way, no amount of money protects you from mental illness. Like, there is no factor that saves you from trauma.
And I think as well, like, you made a really good point about the things that a therapist can spot based on their own experience. Like I say, I've lived with mental health issues now for 16 years, and it's only in the last 2 years that my therapist has even considered the idea that race might have a role in my mental health issues, which when I think about that now is actually, like, for want of a better word, insane, right? Like, how has, even though doctors know the stats, when I'm accessing therapy, we're not going to talk about it at all. It's going to disappear from the conversation. You would never do that with, like, let's say a therapist was working with a child who grew up in care. That would come up in the conversation, right? And it's the same thing. There's this huge thing that has a massive influence on my life, but everyone's going to decide to not talk about it, even though I am accessing the services like I've been told.
Yeah, and there's still such limited provision for that, you know? And so it's like, well, there's these ideas of who is and isn't accessing the support. Another example I've been reading about recently is how, because we're not allowed to express preference via the NHS on what kind of counsellor we would most like to see, that causes dropout rates in other environments. So, for example, if you are someone that has dealt with abuse as a child, there isn't a facility for you to have that taken into account on gender, for example. And so many people drop out of getting that kind of support if they are met with somebody that is the same gender as the person that abused them. You know, it can be as simple as that. And yet we don't have a process to do something about it, in the same way there's not a process for you to have a preference. You know, for some people, race will be a bigger factor than others. And why can't that be included in who you go see?
Completely. And how do you expect people of colour to be able to be their most vulnerable self? Like, therapy isn't something that just works just because. So you have to show up and be as open as you possibly can and as trusting as you possibly can be of the person sat opposite you. And I think it is hard. Having experienced it, I think it is really hard, actually, if I'm honest, to be truly open and vulnerable with a therapist who looks like people that I've received oppression from, people who've inflicted trauma effectively. How can I be vulnerable with somebody who looks like the people that continually inflict trauma
But also, I think there's stuff that goes both ways on that. You know, I'm often in situations where I actively show understanding so that people know that they can talk to me about certain things. Like, I know a lot about black hair. It really interests me. And partly it's because, like, I have curly hair. The products that you generally get in the supermarket, a lot of them just don't work for my hair type. And so some of the stuff I use is designed for hair closer to yours. And Grace has a beautiful big afro for the listeners, than someone with fine blonde hair. You know, the products intended for that hair doesn't suit me. So this is something that interests me, but then I'm also aware of the cultural context. So I might mention certain keywords or certain things I understand as a way for you to know that you can talk to me about stuff. Because this goes both ways. I don't want you to filter yourself and think, well, he won't understand a lot of my experiences, so I'm going to give him the whiteified version of my life.
It's actually those little things that make you, well, make me feel safe, because it feels like a little white flag going up. Like, you know, this person is safe. This person is, you know, cool with what you're presenting them. And that is something that, again, like, this is very new for me, but I'm just starting to learn how I've been impacted by making friends with people, connecting with people, and then learning that they have these ideas or concepts about me or my family, or, you know, and how actually that's happened, you know, probably 20, 30 times in my life where I've genuinely connected with a person who turns out to have really racist ideas. And a lot of people think that that shouldn't happen because I'm obviously, like, I'm a person of color. So then it's like, well, but they didn't hate you. They didn't see you and hate you and think I'm not going to be friends with you. But that's one very narrow way of looking at what racism actually is. And so it's nice to receive those little moments where somebody is essentially saying, like, I understand, I get it, you're safe here, you're right. I actually hadn't thought about that at all, that's a responsibility if you're an ally.
This is why white people need to also be having the conversations, because at the moment we live in such a situation where if there's not a person of color in the room, it's like this issue is off the table. You know, I love it when, you know, I'm a podcaster, I love listening to podcasts. When I hear white people talk about racism amongst themselves, I love it, because it shouldn't be a necessity that there's somebody in the room bringing up that conversation who's not white all the time. You know, maybe we still need people of color to fully understand, but that shouldn't negate the fact that we need to have the conversations among ourselves. And ultimately, it's quite simple. It's a way of connecting. You know, there is a difference between us that is visually there. And one of the bad ways of approaching it would be, oh, I can't address it, I can't mention it. There has to be something else we can do. In the same way, you know, I can maybe show a woman that I understand her experience by saying, oh, would that happen to a man, about something she tells me. There are these little ways that I can show understanding, some of them verbal, some of them not. You know, if I can tell the body language of a woman, if I'm walking behind her and she hears my 6'3" heavy footsteps and she, you know, maybe holds her bag a little bit tighter or looks around her a bit more, I can read certain body language like that, and I just cross the road. Rather than overtake her, I just cross the road and I zoom past with my long legs on the other side of the road. This stuff can help. And like you say, if we can get to a point where skin colour doesn't matter anymore and where people are understanding in this way, then I want to absolutely get to a point where anybody could see any therapist and they will have a level of understanding, and they will bridge the gap for you rather than you as the patient that's struggling right now having to address it all the time.
Yeah. And I think that's so true. Like, it often race throughout my life has felt like the elephant in the room, because I know, again, growing up where I grew up, I've heard many times over, well, I don't think of you as black, I just think of you as Grace. But, like, again, there's a value judgment attached to that. There's nothing wrong with thinking.
Danielle's got her hands over her face.
Like, there's nothing wrong with viewing me as black. A, I know you're lying, because it's so obvious, and I know it's what people see first about me, so let's not front. And B, it's okay. My blackness is not a problem, you know? And I think it's that, like, it's saying, well, I don't notice that you're black. Well, why don't you? Why wouldn't you notice that? Why would you want to squash that? Why would you want to get rid of that idea? I understand that your intention might be good and you don't wish me any ill will. There is still a little voice in the back of your head. And you've just revealed that to me, and that's tough. So instead of saying that, you know, draw attention to that. It's okay. I know that I'm a bit black. I'm aware, and I'm cool with it. So it's okay to notice it and talk about it. And then I don't feel so, like you say, responsible, but also uncomfortable, because every room I walk into, there's an elephant in the room, and it's me.
Yeah, because there's such a strange undertone to that, because what are they really saying? You're black, but I don't hold it against you. What is, do you know what I mean when you boil this down? And you remember what I said about I like having my little lines? You know, one that really resurfaced last year was the good old fun, I don't see colour. And the one I have for that is I do my best acting of looking really genuinely confused, like I've never heard that before, because I wish that was true. I just look them in the eye and say, so how do you do traffic lights?
Yeah. How do you do traffic lights? How do you do anything?
And I like stuff like that because it can help, you know, A, I'm drawing attention to this is really absurd what you've said and here's a quick way of me showing you that. But also it's a way of what do you really mean? Clarify. Let's continue the conversation in a way that I'm also not confronting them.
Yeah.
And I think as well, the part of the conversation that I haven't seen happening much around that, I don't see colour, like it is an absurd thing to say. But also I do believe that there are some people who have gotten themselves to the place in their head where that's true for them. Do you know what I mean? They believe that they don't see colour. And even though that might not actually be 100% true, that's what they believe. And that belief is so entrenched. Like they're so connected to that ideology. They're so connected to, we're just all one human race, so it doesn't matter. And I think that comes from an ideological standpoint, right? They dislike the feeling of negativity that comes with acknowledging race. And so they've squashed it down. Squashed it down so far that they now try not to see race anywhere because they know that what comes with that is really difficult and horrible. But I think ultimately, again, the work has to go into, well, why is it so difficult for us to engage with race? Why is it so problematic? And I, you know, this is like, I have believed that. I have believed that I didn't see race and I didn't see colour. I've believed that at times in my life because it's a more comfortable place to exist. And it's more comfortable for me as a person of colour to believe that nobody sees colour, right? But that's not the reality that we exist in. So it's choosing to interact with the world on an ideological level and not choosing to interact with the world where it currently is.
I think you're absolutely right. And like you say, that can so often come from good intention. But unless we're in a place where race isn't an issue for anyone, we're not yet in a position where we can opt out like that. You know, racism may not be something that you feel that you're part of. And obviously there's the whole conversation about how easy is it to be completely not a part of it, because we live in a society where it's almost impossible. You know, we are sold things so often based on ideals of colorism. You know, I can visit family in Malaysia and it's white people advertising the watches. Like that has anything to do with the function of a watch. But, you know, it reaches so broadly that in a very much not white country, still whiteness is used for marketing. And so we can't entirely opt out of that when it's so constant. And instead, there's ways that we can all examine our behaviour and try and make steps and have the conversations that are difficult, because often they're the ones that we most need to have. And yes, it would be lovely to get to a point where we can opt out of seeing it, where it doesn't matter anymore. But until then, there's still work to be done.
So much work.
He says with a sigh. But we are at the end of our time nearly. And I just wanted to finish up then talking about the work you're doing in schools as you're part of trying to address this right from a young age, because like you said with your own experience, this comes before kids even have any of the language to understand it. They're already seeing this stuff. And so would you mind sharing a bit about that?
course I wouldn't. Okay, so yeah, I Am Ally, essentially, I created it to work in schools primarily with teachers. The idea is that I will work with teachers and students, but the idea is that I'm skilling teachers up to be able to A, have conversations about race, B, manage challenging situations that occur within school connected to race, ensure that they can lead classes around race education. And the reason that I've made this a teacher first kind of plan is that if I decided that it was just going to be me and other Black and brown people traveling into schools to deliver education to students, that's a model that has no end. And that means that the responsibility is always going to be here. And I think that it was really important to ensure that that didn't happen with this. I also think that we're moving in a direction where it's probably inevitable that at some point or other, be that in the next decade or two, that teachers will be expected to teach more education that is connected to Black history. That really scares me because I grew up in a time where people were acknowledging the need for art and culture and resources created by Black and brown people to be put on the curriculum or to be present in school. And for me, that process of giving people art to look at and starting conversations in an education setting where people were ill-equipped to have those conversations, that added to my trauma. So various experiences that I remember being laughed at by a whole class because of something that we were discussing that a teacher didn't manage well. Moments where teachers were providing education that was inaccurate and incorrect about the language spoken in the Caribbean. So my teacher referred to it as patois. And I was like, oh, that's awkward. And then when I kind of tentatively said, oh, that's not what that's called, actually, it's called patois, I was then confronted with this teacher who obviously felt really silly and uncomfortable and reacted badly to that. So then said, okay, well, Grace is going to read out the poem then, seems as she speaks patois all the time, which I don't. So I was then in this situation where I felt really dumb and stupid. I felt like everyone was looking at me. I felt incredibly disconnected from my culture, my heritage. I felt just all of these awful things and I had nowhere to go with them. And that situation was something that was created almost entirely by the teacher in that setting. And the fact that this existed on the curriculum and they were ill-equipped to deal with it. The list goes on, right? There was...
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a funny one to me because I'm like, what's the solution there? You never leave school? You help them teach that class forever? No, they have a responsibility to understand. In the same way, if they didn't know how to do a piece of algebra, that would be reflected on their ability to teach. On, you know, the Ofsted would pick up on that. And yet it's only in the last few years that more of this stuff is being added. I mean, from a mental health perspective, it's only as of last year that Ofsted has a framework around judging how mental health is supported in schools. And I've got to be a part of that. But even that's an example of people like myself with experience of mental ill health banging the drum constantly for change that seems quite obvious.
Exactly. And I think because we have a history in the UK of not properly working things through and wanting to do something that appears good and appears to tackle the issue, I feel like I can just see this happening where teachers are going to be thrown this thing that is incredibly complicated, incredibly difficult to manage because you are teaching lots of different people. They're going to be thrown this thing. They're not going to be given any support and education in terms of how they go about teaching this. And what they will end up doing inadvertently, not through their own, not because of their own fault, but because of the fault of the system, they will create trauma for people of colour. And that terrifies me because that's what I experienced. And so the idea here is that I help to equip teachers before it's, you know, before it's too late so that they can get ahead of this and know how to have conversations about this and create change within the systems that exist in their schools and within education generally, but so they feel confident that they can do it. And so the idea then is that you've got one or a couple of teachers in a school that are clued up on this stuff. And then I help those teachers train more teachers. And so the idea is that within one school, you could end up with this little domino effect where before you know it, all of the teachers know how to give this education. And then I'm surplus to requirements. And that genuinely is my dream, is that we're able to get so efficient at doing this and doing it well that I am not needed anymore.
Yeah, and that's what the teachers need. You know, they need the proper support so that they're set up to do well in the same way. You know, one of my number one things with the mental health education was, what support are the teachers getting? Like, at every opportunity, that was the thing I was pushing more for, because I don't want to be in a situation where the burden is put on teachers that aren't prepared to teach it, because that can also go both ways. You know, then what if the education isn't there, the few teachers in a school that are people of colour, they've got to teach all those classes, it's the same burden. Or, you know, it gets around the office that one teacher has depression, so everyone comes to them with their mental health questions. That doesn't make you a doctor.
No, and I think that can be hugely impactful.
So if you want to find out more about I Am Ally, then we have our own website and we have an Instagram. So it's www.iamally.co.uk.
Wonderful. Well, I think that is brilliant. I'm so proud of you for doing this work. And I'd really encourage people to check it out and check out the previous episode we did together as well, all about self-esteem, if they scroll way back in the podcast feed. But yeah, thank you so much for sharing.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.